What about the Morrigan?
No one knows, because no one has spoken to her.
Briett grinned wryly.
I think Angus was worried she would end his plotting prematurely. For my part, I would rather not be in her debt. She does not work well with others.
She's spoken to me, I said. She's already suspicious that something is going on, and is incensed at being left out.
She'll get herself involved as she chooses. Are you willing to get involved, Druid?
I already am involved, it seems.
I'm asking you to choose sides. My side, specifically.
Done, I said instantly. What moral dilemma was there? She wanted me to keep the sword, Angus wanted to take it. She liked me alive, Angus didn't. She was hot, Angus was not.
Methinks.
She smiled so warmly I felt as if my kidneys had melted.
Kill Angus Og for me, and I shall reward you.
I have to admit that some of the warm fuzzies flew away right there. It made me feel like a mercenary.
And should you run into some demons, I have a gift for you. Give me your right hand.
I placed my right hand in her left. Her palm was cool to the touch, calloused from the forge. Her fingers were long and strong. She placed her right index finger onto the loop of my tattoo and tried to do something. Uh-oh.
I do not understand,
she frowned.
Something is preventing me from giving you the power of cold fire.
I kept my face carefully neutral, while part of me was screaming inside and another part was thinking, cool! My amulet had just prevented her from performing magic on me. It might have even protected me from summary incineration had the meeting gone differently. It was not the sort of thing I wanted to test. But now she would become aware of its existence, and things could get awkward.
Your aura is strange, Druid,
she said, sitting back in her chair, noticing it for the first time.
What have you done to it?
I've bound it with cold iron, I said, pulling my necklace out from underneath my shirt. It protects me from most magic. Briett said nothing at first, just sat and stared at my necklace. Then she said,
It is also protecting you from my aid. I cannot give you cold fire. If you face any demons, you'll be left to your own devices, and I cannot see how that will avail you if you cannot use magic.
Oh, I can use magic.
Does not the iron prevent it?
I have discovered a solution to the old problem.
Remarkable that you have found one where I have not,
said the goddess of the forge. Have you truly tried?
No,
she admitted.
I thought it was impossible.
Turns out it's only next to impossible.
Have you tested it against demons?
It prevents succubi from casting their charms on me.
But you have not had to deal with hellfire or any other hellish attacks.
Not yet.
You'll need to test it soon. You need a way to deal with demons, lots of them, if I'm right about who Angus has been talking to.
What does this cold fire do?
It allows you to burn them from within, but it burns like ice burns. It takes a lot of energy and it drains you. Even if you draw power from the earth, it'll drain you, but it'll save you from being overwhelmed in a fight. Alas, I cannot give it to you.
Sure you can, I said, and I took the necklace off. It changed my aura immediately, and I became nervous. She could hurt me as easily as help me now, if she liked.
That is truly wondrous craft, Sheehan,
she said, admiringly, noticing how my aura changed. She'd forgotten my chosen name already and used the one I was born with.
I would have you teach it to me.
I was afraid of this. My apologies, Briett, but I have sworn to keep it a secret. I left out the rest of the sentence, which said, except from the Morrigan, and hurried on before she thought to ask to whom I had sworn. But now that you know such a thing is possible, I have no doubt that you can figure it out on your own. I counsel patience. This craft took me 750 years. She did not appear offended, thankfully. Disappointed, yes. But as she continued to stare at the necklace on the table next to her gauntlets, her expression slowly changed. She looked delighted.
You've given me a new challenge, Druid, and a most worthy one, she said. I will try to fashion my own in a shorter period of time. I know you cannot tell me how it was made without breaking your oath, but will you allow me to inspect it from time to time?
Of course, I said.
Am I right in thinking this necklace will work for no one but you?
Yes, it is bound specifically to me. For anyone else, it would simply be jewelry.
I see now why you have survived so long.
I blushed at her compliment, and she put out her left hand again, smiling. I placed my right hand in hers, and she held it as she touched her finger to the loop of my tattoo. This time, I felt something. A rush of heat and ice through my veins and a spell of dizziness.
Now you have the power of cold fire, Briet said. It works only on Hellspawn, and both you and your targets must be touching the earth. Point at your targets with your right hand, collect your will, and say doi, and they'll be destroyed. Though I warn you again, it takes a tremendous amount of your energy, so use it sparingly. And remember, it'll also take a few moments for them to die.
Thank you, Briet.
Don't thank me yet,
she said, giving Oberon a last scratch before donning her gauntlets again.
Despite the advantages you have, you are all that is keeping Aengus Og and his allies from moving openly against me. They are legion, and you are one man, and I am glad you are so willing to stand in front of them. But I half expect you to be dead by the dawn.
On that cheery note, she leaned across the table and kissed me. She tasted of milk and honey and berries, and it was simply blissful.
You've been kissed by three goddesses in as many days,
Oberon said once Briet had left.
So I think you owe me 300 French poodles. That should make us about even.
Chapter 15. I thought Sundays were supposed to be relaxing. As a male citizen of America, I'm entitled on Sundays to watch athletic men in tight uniforms ritualistically invade one another's territory. And while they're resting, I get to be bombarded with commercials about trucks, pizza, beer, and financial services. That's how it's supposed to be. That's the American dream. I suppose I cannot complain, because I'm not really a citizen of America. Mr. Samurgian called the INS on me once, in fact. I waved my hand in front of the agents' faces and said, I'm not the druid you're looking for. They were not amused. I waved my hand again and said, move along. And they got out their handcuffs. That's when I got out my slightly scuffed yet Songye illegal documents, prepared for me by Leif Helgerson, blood-sucking attorney at law. And after the INS agents went away, that's when I sent Oberon over to poop on Mr. Samurgian's lawn for the first time. We have not been on good terms since then. We never were, of course, but at least for the first few years he cheerfully ignored me. When he began to harass me, I suspected him of being either abysmally stupid or a pawn of the Fae. Turned out he was just mean, and dog shit on his lawn turned him into Flibbertigibbet, a regular Lebanese Tom O'Bedlam. Now, I suspected I was a pawn of the Fae. I didn't know whose pawn I was, precisely. I felt somewhat like Korea, with the United States and China fighting a proxy war through me. I didn't want to be a pawn, or Korea. It would be better to be a knight, or Denmark. The Danes used to kick everyone's ass, until their victims figured out where they came from. And that was precisely my problem. People knew where to find me, especially, it seemed, on this particular Sunday. I was calling a contractor to do an emergency replacement of my melted shop door when I saw, through the window, a familiar Crown Victoria pull up. Detective Carlos Jimenez climbed out, and shortly afterward a couple more cars screeched into parking spaces and cops with sunglasses lumbered out of them to adjust their waistbands and check that their shirts were still tucked in. Detective Darren Fagles, the one who fancied himself a reservoir dog, had an official-looking piece of paper flapping in his hand. The legal-sized sort, with lots of fine print. I hung up the phone as the contractor was in mid-sentence and told Oberon to leap up on top of the far table by the wall. Curl yourself on top and don't move a muscle. Not an ear twitch, not a tail wag, nothing until these guys leave.
What guys?
He said as he moved to obey. Those cops are coming. If any of them manages to see you somehow, I want you to run out of here and go straight to the widow's backyard and hide there, okay? Don't wait for me to tell you.
You think they can see through the camouflage?
They might be able to. They've certainly had help getting this far. Oberon jumped gingerly onto the table, dwarfing it but just able to coil himself on its top. As soon as he settled down, all hints of his presence disappeared. I shot a quick glance at Fragorin, still resting on the shelf underneath my counter, and cast camouflage on it for insurance. As the cops grouped together and began to walk toward the door, I wondered if they had decided to come here first or if they had visited my house. If they had visited my house first, where the hell were my lawyers? A horn honked loudly, demanding attention, as a metallic blue BMW Z4 growled to a halt behind Fagel's. Hal Hauck sprang out the door as if summoned.
"Pardon me, are you Detective Fagel's?"
Hal said, placing himself in the detective's way, perhaps a bit faster than a normal human could. The other officers registered this and tensed. A couple of hands drifted toward holsters.
"Stand aside, sir, I'm on official police business," Fagel's commanded.
Hal wasn't intimidated in the least.
"If your business is with Third Eye Books or its owner, then your business is with me," he said. "I am the attorney of record for Mr. Atticus O'Sullivan."
"You're the attorney of record. Then who was the other guy at his house?"
"One of my associates. He called me and reported that your search of his house was not entirely legal, and I assure you that we'll be making a complaint, perhaps filing suit."
That got the cops' attention. They glowered at Hal, and Fagel sneered.
"We have a warrant signed by a Tempe judge."
He held it in front of Hal's face to emphasize his point. "Our search was entirely legal."
"But that warrant gives you permission to search for an Irish wolfhound or similar dog, I believe, and nothing more. Is that correct, Detective?"
Fagel's didn't want to answer with a flat-out yes, so he tried to sound defiant as he replied,
"That's what the warrant says."
"An Irish wolfhound is a very large breed of dog. I saw the specific dog you're looking for before he ran away, and I assure you he weighs almost as much as you. That being given, we can assume that the dog could not possibly be hiding in a drawer or a dresser or in kitchen cupboards or underneath a basil plant. Yet you and your colleagues searched through all those things at my client's house in clear violation of his civil rights."
I didn't need to hear any more than that to know they weren't looking for just my dog. Angus Ogue had sent these guys to find Fragorin, and they had torn up my basil in the kitchen. At least, I hope that was all. If they got my whole backyard herb garden, which I had left camouflaged, Oberon would have to make a run for it soon.
"We did no such thing," Fagel said.
"My associate will testify that you did."
"His word against ours.
He took some video of your search procedure with his cell phone."
Fagel's bit back his initial retort and ground his teeth for a moment. Then he said,
"Look, whoever you are,"
Hal Hauck,
"whatever, we have a legal warrant to search these premises. You will stand aside now or we will arrest you."
"I will stand aside, Detective, but I warn you not to repeat the methods you used at my client's house. You're looking for a large dog, nothing more, and I'll be recording your search. If you look in places where a large dog cannot possibly be hiding, then the lawsuit we bring against you will be much, much worse."
"Fine."
"Fine," Al said. "I'll take that." And he snatched the warrant out of Fagel's hand, faster than the eye could track, before stepping aside. Fagel's was pissed. He had probably wanted to slap the warrant against Hal's chest or something like that, a not-too-subtle push or jab to establish his superiority. But Hal had not only robbed him of that, he had made Fagel's look slow and stupid, which, compared to Hal, he was. In Fagel's defense, he didn't know he was trying to play dominance games with a werewolf. Rather than say anything to deepen his humiliation, Fagel stalked forward, with Jimenez and the others close behind. He paused at the door, examining the broken glass around the edges and scattered on the floor inside. He peered through at me before stepping across the threshold. I was standing to his left, behind my counter, access to which was open and visible from the shop entrance.
"What happened here, O'Sullivan?"
he said. "A customer objected strenuously to my returns policy," I said.
"Yeah, right,"
Fagel's muttered as he stepped through the door. As soon as he did, wards around my shop alerted me that he had a binding on him. I looked closely at his aura as he gestured for the others to file in and start searching, and I turned on my fairy specs. A band of green knotwork wreathed Fagel's skull, almost like one of those Roman laurels. That was the primary method by which he was being controlled, but interlaced with those strands, I saw, were very fine blue and red threads. I could not break the green binding without breaking those too, and I didn't know what those were for, though I assumed they weren't friendly by their design. Fail-safes, perhaps, or magical booby traps, or merely something for me to waste my time on. The other officers, I noted quickly, had nothing about them beyond their normal human auras, all tinged with aggression and stress, but that was only to be expected after being schooled by a lawyer. Hal followed Jimenez and the other cops as they spread out through the store, which meant I could safely focus all my attention on Fagles. He remained by the door, transfixed by something he saw on my counter shelves.
"What's that?"
Fagles said, jerking his chin vaguely in my direction. "What's what?"
"That," he said, removing his sunglasses and pointing. "That looks like a scabbard. You have a sword behind your counter?"
He folded his sunglasses and slipped them into his shirt pocket before looking at me expectantly.
"Nope." "Don't lie to me, I can see it."
Right. That told me quite a bit. If he could see the sword and not Oberon, who truly was sitting in plain sight on a table across the room, then Angus had given him a very selective ability. It wasn't the ability to see through camouflage, which would have instantly revealed to him the purported target of his search. Rather, it was the specific ability to see Fragora, which was supposed to be magically cloaked. That cloak had worked very well on Bress, so it should work equally well on Fagles, except that he seemed attuned to it. How does one get attuned to a cloaked item? You need to have a lot of help from the person who cast the cloak in the first place. That meant Radomiwa, leader of the Sisters of the Three Auroras. Fagles was walking, talking evidence they were working against me with Angus Og.
"Is it a dog, detective?"
Hal asked, swinging around from surveying Jimenez's progress to confront Fagles. He stopped a couple of paces away from the detective, far enough into the shop that he wouldn't see what Fagles was looking at.
"Because if it's not, then it's none of your business."
The detective ignored him and said to me,
"That's a deadly weapon you're hiding, and you need a permit for that. Do you have a concealed weapons permit?"
"Don't answer," Hal told me, and pointed his cell phone at Fagles. "I'm recording this, detective. According to Arizona Revised Statute 133102, subsection G, a permit is not necessary for weapons carried in a belt holster that is wholly or partially visible, or carried in a scabbard or case designed for carrying weapons that is wholly or partially visible."
Whoa. That's why Hal gets $3.50 an hour. Quoting Arizona statutes, complete with their soul-destroying legalistic sentence structure? That's druidic.
"That is not a concealed weapon," Hal continued. "Nor is it a dog, which is all you are authorized to search for."
I tuned the two of them out as they continued to wrangle over whether the scabbard was concealed or not on my shelf, and turned my attention to the bindings floating about Fagel's impeccably coiffed dome. My hunch was that the blue knots represented the binding that allowed him to see the cloak, which was, in turn, allowing him to penetrate the camouflage. So if I unraveled that particular binding, the problem of my sword would quite literally disappear. The trouble was that breaking the blue knots would snap the red ones, too. And while I could appreciate the craft that went into these particular bindings, I still had no way of telling precisely what Angus had wrought there. Perhaps the Morrigan or Briett could tell me precisely what spells the knots represented and how to deal with them safely, but the best I could figure was that the red knots were bad juju. If I took time to deal with it, it might go off in response to my tampering anyway, and I would still need to deal with the blue knot afterward, because I could tell Fagles wouldn't give up until he tried taking the sword from me. Angus wouldn't have it any other way. And the green knot? That would be a direct magical battle with Angus Og for control of Fagles, during the course of which he would learn quite a bit about my abilities, and I didn't want to tip my hand quite that much yet. Here, then, would be a true test of my wards and bindings. I decided to activate all the magic dampening I could from my shop's wards, then go after the blue knots and let the red knots do whatever they were designed to do. Damn the consequences. It was one of those decisions you make when you have too much testosterone bubbling around in your system, or when you've been raised in a culture of ridiculous machismo, as I was. The blue knot was absurdly fragile. It snapped almost immediately with the gentlest of mental tugs, and the red one snapped along with it. Definitely a trap, the concussive sort. I felt a whoomp against my face, like getting hit unexpectedly full force with a pillow, and I saw Hal's head snap back abruptly. He fell over backwards, snarling in surprise. Bagels yelped and grabbed at his head, and then as Hal and I were recovering, Hal red-faced and eyes a bit yellow, his wolf close to the surface, Bagels went completely batshit and drew his gun on me.
"Hands up!"
he yelled. And of course that brought all the other cops running over, Jimenez in the lead, drawing his gun out too. I raised my hands and wondered what would have happened if I hadn't activated the shop's wards first. Hal might have had his head taken off. He had taken a good shot as it was, and I got only a fraction of the power thanks to the stronger protection of my necklace. Fagles was reacting to some magical feedback, nothing more, and it looked like none of the other cops farther away had felt a thing. They were just backing Fagles' play.
"What happened?"
Oberon asked. "It's okay. Don't move," I told him.
Whoa, detective, that's not necessary. You're pointing a gun at an unarmed man who's cooperating with a legal search,"
Hal said, panting a bit.
"Bullshit! He assaulted me!"
Fagel spat.
"What? That's nonsense, man. He's been standing there passively more than 5 feet away from you the entire time."
"He just hit me upside the head."
"Well, I'm sure he deserved it, Atticus."
"Hush, I didn't hit him."
"He most certainly did not, and that security camera right there will prove it," Hal exclaimed, pointing at the camera.
All eyes followed his finger and saw that it would most definitely prove whether or not I had moved to slap Detective Fagles upside the head. Fagles heard the certainty in Hal's voice, saw the doubt in his colleagues' faces, and practically stomped his foot as he cried,
"Well, something hit my head, and it sure as hell wasn't me!"
"Something hit me too, Detective, but it wasn't my client, and there's no reason to keep pointing your gun at him. Let's all calm down now."
"I want to know what hit me,"
Fagles insisted.
"And hey, where'd the sword go? It's gone."
It wasn't gone, but he couldn't see it now that I had snapped that blue knot. The camouflage was in effect. "What sword?" I said, playing dumb.
"The sword that we were just talking about,"
Fagles screamed.
"The one that was on that shelf!"
He pointed impotently at the spot where my sword still lay, hidden from his unaided vision.
"Now that's funny," Oberon said. "I think his panties are getting twisted. If I had any sausages to spare, I would give you one for that right there."
"You saw it too?"
Fagles accused Hal, looking around at the other cops who were eyeing him a bit uncertainly.
"How could I have seen it, Detective? I'm on this side of the counter,"
Hal pointed out, the very picture of reason and affability.
"But you argued about it with me."
"That's because I'm paid to argue about things. But I never saw this sword you're referring to. I merely objected to you taking anything not included in the warrant. Speaking of which, has anyone found the large dog yet?"
Detective Jimenez sighed and put away his gun, and all the other cops relaxed too, save for Fagles. They were beginning to look a bit embarrassed.
"I still don't know what hit me, and I want an answer,"
Fagles ground out, his chin lifted obstinately.
"I think it was a freak gust of wind, Detective," Hal said, "coming through the broken door. I felt it too."
That did it for Detective Jimenez.
"The dog isn't here, Fagles," he said. "Let's go. Put the gun away."
Fagles gritted his teeth in frustration, and the green wreath around his head flared menacingly. And that's when he shot me. Chapter 16. You know that old saw about your life flashing before your eyes at the moment of death? Well, if you've lived more than 2,000 years, it's going to take a while for your subconscious to put together a decent retrospective. And I imagine that there must be one of those spinning beach balls of death hovering over my head, like when I asked my computer to do too many things at once. But that's not the first thing I thought about as I fell to the ground with a hole in my chest. It was the second. The first thing I thought was,
"Oh no, I've been shot!"
In the immortal words of the Golden Protocol droid when he got lased with special effects in a mining colony. As I waited for my life's highlight reel, much like those tributes they play at the Oscars every year, to play in my mind, quite a few people became excited in my shop. All the cops, led by Jimenez, pulled their guns back out and pointed them at Fagles, shouting at him to put his gun down now.
and Oberon wanted to start tearing into him right away.
Atticus!
It's okay, buddy. Stay there. I'll be fine. Poor Fagles. Even as I watched from flat on my back, the green binding about his head dissolved. He came back to full conscious control of his mind to find himself standing over me with a smoking gun hanging from his hand and five cops pointing their guns at him. His voice, thin and trembling, said,
"It wasn't me." "Drop the gun, Fagles,"
Jimenez commanded. Fagles didn't seem to hear.
"There was someone in my mind, telling me what to do. He wanted the sword."
"There is no sword," Hal spoke up. "Only my unarmed client bleeding on the floor." That drew my attention back to my condition and how very, very much it hurt. Thanks a lot, Hal. I was bleeding out pretty good, and I had a punctured left lung that was filling up with blood as well. I reached for some power to begin healing, and didn't have any to tap. I'd used everything I had stored in my bear charm on casting camouflage and dealing with Angus Oak's bindings. I needed to get outside where I could touch the earth, but Fagles was still standing there, and the cops were still telling him to drop the gun, and no one was dialing 911 while they had an unarmed rogue cop to deal with. Owie.
"But I didn't shoot him. It wasn't me,"
Fagles pleaded.
"You don't understand. There's a security camera and six witnesses who watched you pull the trigger on an unarmed, unresisting man," Jimenez said. "You know what that means. Drop the weapon now, Fagles."
Tears began leaking from Fagles' eyes and his chin quivered.
"I don't understand how this happened," he said. "I would never do something like this." "We all saw you do it," Jimenez said. "Last warning. Drop the weapon or we'll be forced to shoot you."
The direct threat jarred Fagles out of his self-pity.
"Oh, you're going to shoot me, are you?"
he sneered, and then he became unhinged.
"Well, that's better than going to prison, and even better than that would be taking you with me. Fagles, don't!"
And then there was a lot of noise. Fagles' inchoate roar of rage against what he knew to be injustice, his brief attempt to raise his weapon, and then the percussive explosions of five guns going off, sending Fagles howling backward through the door, and finally the curses of the cops who knew they'd all be sitting on their asses for days pending investigation.
"Somebody get the paramedics here and some black and whites to block off the street," Jimenez said. "And we're going to need that security tape."
Hal rushed forward and knelt down to see how I was doing.
"I need to get outside to draw some power,"
I whispered at him.
"Lung filling up with blood."
And then I coughed some up for him by way of punctuation.
"How's he doing?"
Jimenez asked, looking over Hal's shoulder.
"Help me move him. He needs air,"
Hal said, and the detective backed off.
"Whoa, we need to wait for the paramedics. We're not supposed to do anything."
"Fine, I'll do it myself,"
Hal said, and he hooked an arm under my shoulders and knees and scooped me up as effortlessly as he would an Italian runway model. "Silly cop, I don't need your help. I have a werewolf on retainer."
"Hey, if he dies, it's going to be your fault."
"If he dies, he can sue me," Hal said. "Get out of the way."
He sidestepped through the broken door, over the body of Detective Fagles, and then placed me down on the grass strip outside my shop. I gasped in relief as I immediately began to draw power from the earth. Between bloody coughs, I spoke quietly so that only Hal would be able to hear me as I began closing my wounds.
"I need the sword. It's invisible, but you can feel it on the shelf. Bring it to me. And get someone over here to clean up all of my blood. Completely sanitize the place, every drop, including your clothes."
Hal looked down and saw my blood all over him.
"This is a $3,000 suit.
I'm good for it. Gotta get the door fixed, too, and Oberon will need looking after."
I thought I smelled him," Hal said.
I nodded.
"He's in the shop, camouflaged like the sword. I'll tell him to jump in your beamer."
"Okay, I'll go open the door and leave it open. But tell him to be careful on the leather seats."
"Sybarite,"
I said.
"Ascetic,"
he retorted, and he got up to go open his car door. I heard sirens wailing in an urban imitation of the Banshee, and as I poured everything I could into accelerating my healing, I reached out to Oberon.
"Okay, Oberon, I'm healing up fine, but they're going to come take me to the hospital for a while, and I need you to go with Hal for now.
I should be back tomorrow.
Why do you need to go at all?
There's some fluid in my lungs, and I can't get that out without some help. Hal has opened the door of his car for you. Try to get out of the store as quietly as you can and watch out for blood on the ground, because your paw prints will give you away. There's a dead body right outside the door, so be careful.
There are a lot of people milling around by the door.
There's going to be more of them soon. The longer you wait, the more there'll be. I'm outside on the ground to the right.
Wait. What's wrong? Is that tiny little toy car Hal's?
It's a very expensive toy. You're supposed to be careful with the leather seats.
So, I'm supposed to ninja past these cops, tread across the broken glass. You remember the broken glass, right? Avoid the buckets of blood outside the door, and jump silently into that puny car without saying hello to the upholstery?
An excellent summation. Make it quick.
Not so fast. Promise you'll get me a date with the French poodle.
Seriously? You're holding out on me right now? I've been shot and I'm coughing up blood and you're negotiating for some tail?
Oh, all right. But I totally deserve one and you know it. I've been a good widow doggy.
It was at this moment that Perry, who had slunk out of the shop more than an hour ago under the glowing red eyes of the Morrigan, chose to return from lunch.
Holy shit, boss, he said. Did that big fucking bird do all of this?
Chapter 17. I beckoned Perry over.
I'll explain what happened later,
I said as he squatted next to me in the grass.
The bird was just the beginning, but listen.
I paused to cough up some more blood.
Damn, Atticus. I knew that bird was bad news. I'm sorry, man. I should have stayed to help you out.
Don't worry about it. You can help me now. You're on the clock until you get a glass contractor out here to fix up the door. Once that's done, lock up and head home. Open up tomorrow for me and make a cup of humility tea. There's some sachets already made. You know the one I'm talking about. The one that sorority girls ask for when they want to end a relationship.
Perry nodded and grinned wryly.
Good. Make it for a customer named Emily. Don't tell her anything about what you saw here or where I'm at or anything. Is that clear? If she asks you what the weather's like outside, you shrug your shoulders and say you don't know, all right?
Got it, boss.
That goes for everybody who asks anything. Tell them I'll be back in a few days. If you don't know how to make a certain kind of tea for someone, then don't even try. Just apologize and tell them I'll be back soon.
Is that true? I tried to laugh, but coughed instead.
What? That I'll be back? I certainly hope so.
You're not going to be in the hospital for weeks, because that looks like a bullet hole in your shirt.
As the Black Knight famously said, that's just a flesh wound. The Black Knight always triumphs,
Perry beamed. Monty Python is like catnip for nerds. Once you get them started quoting it, they're constitutionally incapable of feeling depressed.
That's right. It would greatly ease my mind if you took care of things, Perry. And if a guy named Hal tells you to do anything, you do it as if it came from my mouth, okay? He's my attorney. Speaking of whom, here he is.
Hal returned from the inside of the store, and he had Fragorak clutched invisibly in his left hand. He knelt down on the other side of me, seeming to use his left hand for support, but in truth laying the sword down in the grass against my side. As he did this, he held out his right hand to Perry to distract him.
Pleased to meet you. I'm Hal Hulk, he said.
Barry Thomas, he said, taking Hal's hand and shaking it. I work for Atticus.
Excellent. Let's get you inside then, past all the police. I'll be right back, Atticus, he said to me.
They rose and left me there, and I took the opportunity to check on Oberon.
Where are you now? Where do you expect? I'm totally a ninja wolfhound. This car's ridiculous, though. There's a revolting citrus air freshener in here. Do you know when his birthday is? We should get him one that smells like steak or Italian sausage.
I'm not sure they make them in those scents, Oberon.
Why not? You'd think they'd sell like milk bones, especially to a werewolf who's trying to compensate for something with a slick sports car.
Ow. Don't make me laugh right now. After giving Oberon a mental scratch on the head, I went to work on Fragorak. I dispelled the camouflage as the ambulance arrived because I didn't want anyone to accidentally touch it and freak out, then placed a binding on the scabbard that would prevent it from moving farther than 5 feet from me. I had wanted to do this in the shop in case Fagles ever got his hands on it, but the binding takes longer to cast than camouflage and requires more power, and I didn't have access to much of either earlier. Jimenez came out to meet the paramedics and pointed them in my direction. Hal also came out and asked them to take me to Scottsdale Memorial Hospital, where my personal doctor could operate on me. I didn't really have a personal doctor, but the pack did. Dr. Snorri Yoderson was part of the pack himself, and he was the go-to guy for the paranormal community in the Phoenix area. He didn't raise an eyebrow at unusually fast healing, for example, and he was rumored to be an excellent bone setter and a quick surgeon. He was also willing to do things off the books. He had a whole surgical team who would work off record for obscene amounts of cash. I'd met him a couple of times when I ran with the pack. He was probably sixth or seventh in their hierarchy. But I'd never had cause to use his professional services, until now. The reason people like me need people like Snorri is because of reactions like the paramedics had when they examined me.
"I thought you were supposed to have been shot," one of them said.
"I was. Fluid in my lungs," I gurgled. "I'm stable, but I need to see my doctor."
"Well, where's the bullet hole?"
"Whoops. In my haste to prevent infection, I probably grew that skin over a bit too fast. It was still angry red, I'm sure, but not an open wound anymore. I'd put all my effort into closing up the skin and the lung, so the muscle tissue on either side was still pretty torn and would take some time to mend, and the skin and lung tissue needed time to strengthen, too.
It was a rubber bullet. Hit me there and caused internal bleeding," I said.
"Detectives don't use rubber bullets. And even if they did and it caused some internal bleeding, you shouldn't have fluid in your lung from that."
"Tell you what, sport, put me on a stretcher and get me to my doctor and let him worry about it."
I was ready to go. I had done all I could here, including a recharge of my bear charm. Now I needed a surgeon and some time.
"You mean to tell me your bullet wound healed up that fast?"
"I mean to tell you to give me one of those oxygen masks and get me out of here, and the sword comes with me."
I patted Fragara, and the paramedic looked down, noticing it for the first time.
"Doesn't leave my side."
"What? We cannot allow weapons in the ambulance?"
"It's sheathed, and it's incredibly valuable. Look at my shop."
I gestured toward the broken door.
"I can't leave it here."
Hal, who had been hanging back silently watching the proceedings, loomed suddenly over the paramedic's shoulder.
"Are you refusing to transport my client in a medical emergency?"
"No,"
the paramedic replied, squinting up at him.
"I'm refusing to transport his weapon."
"You mean his priceless Celtic art?" "That's not a weapon, sir. It's a family heirloom of intense sentimental value, and the trauma he would suffer by being separated from it would be greater than any physical pain he currently feels, which, I notice, you've done absolutely nothing about since you arrived."
The paramedic clenched his jaw and exhaled sharply through his nose as he turned back to me.
"Having lawyers?"
he muttered quietly, thinking perhaps Hal wouldn't hear it. But werewolves tend to hear things like that.
"That's right, sir. I am an effing lawyer, and I will effing file suit against you if you don't effing get my client and his art to Scottsdale Memorial right now."
"All right, whatever,"
huffed the paramedic, who could not stand to be bludgeoned with lawsuit threats for long. He and his partner went to get the stretcher, and shortly I was being loaded into the back of the ambulance, Fragara clutched in my right hand. Jimenez and the other cops were so busy worrying about what the press would do when they found out that a Phoenix detective had shot a Tempe detective stone dead that they completely missed the fact that the sword Fagles had been hollering about actually existed.
"I'll see you there soon," Hal said with a wave. "Snorri will take good care of you. He knows you're coming. And don't worry about these guys," he said, indicating the paramedics. "Leaf will pay them a visit tonight, and they won't remember a thing."
Since the paramedics had finally put an oxygen mask on me, I couldn't answer, so I just gave a weak nod.
"Hurry back, Atticus. I'm going to be bored. These werewolves can't talk to me, and this camouflage stuff still kind of tickles."
"I'll probably see you by lunchtime tomorrow," I said back to my dog.
"Will there be sausage?"
"Only if Hal tells me you've been good."
"I'm going to hold you to that,"
Oberon said, his mental voice fading as the ambulance put some distance between us.
"Okay, be good then,"
I projected and hoped he heard it. We warbled up Mill Avenue and doubtless gave the stoners loitering on the corner outside Trippy Hippie a quick jolt of paranoia.
Sirens just harsh on their mellow, man.
Drives in the back of an ambulance are simultaneously boring and stressful. I needed relief from both. Paramedic man wasn't about to talk to me anymore, so I decided to mess with him a bit, since Leaf would make sure he wouldn't remember anything later. Am I above immature trickery? No. It keeps me young. Using a bit of power recently banked in my bear charm, I bound a few of the natural threads in the elastic band of his underwear to the fine hairs in the center of his back about 5 inches up. The result was an instant wedgie. Those have been funny for 2,000 years, but they're even more hilarious when your victim is sanctimoniously trying to behave like he knows more than you. I really shouldn't have done it, though, because his reaction, a girlish squeal followed by a high-octave,
"Ow! What the fuck?"
and an abrupt attempt to stand up, which cracked his head on the ceiling, got me laughing too hard, and that brought on a serious case of bloody hacking and a heaping spoonful of pain. Served me right, I suppose. I messed up the inside of the oxygen mask, then released the binding so he could calm down and help me. He never saw me laughing, so the poor guy thought his antics had caused me to become upset, and he was very solicitous as soon as he was able to reestablish some room in his shorts. Best ambulance ride ever. When we got to the hospital and his partner came around to help unload me from the back, he noticed that Mr. Wedgie had a flushed face. "What happened?" he asked.
"He had a bit of distress during the ride, but he's stable for the moment," Wedgie said as they put my rolling stretcher on the ground and started pushing me toward the sterile electric doors of the emergency room.
"But you look like something happened to you," his partner replied. "Are you okay, man?"
"I'm fine," Wedgie snapped. "Nothing happened. Jesus Christ!" Well, I couldn't resist when he was lying like that, could I? Besides, there's that saying about laughter being the best medicine.
Whoever said that didn't have blood in their left lung, though, I feel certain. Dr. Snorri Yodersen got his first look at me while I was in the midst of another hacking fit. He appeared to be in his 40s, though of course he was older than that, like all the members of the Tempe pack. He was dressed in blue scrubs, which drew attention to the startling blue ice of his eyes and the blonde eyebrows furrowed above them. His sharp nose and chiseled jaw made him look like a thunder god, though considering his pack's antipathy for Thor, that wasn't a compliment I would think of paying him aloud. He had his blonde hair cropped fairly close along the sides, but it was tousled and teased on the top after the fashion of frat boy douchebags, and I wasn't going to tell him that either.
"Atticus, I've seen you looking better," he said, as he kept pace with the gurney being wheeled into pre-op by a couple of nurses. "Tell me what you can when you feel up to it."
"Am I able to talk freely?" I asked, tilting my eyes toward the nurses rolling my gurney.
"Oh yes, they're part of my team," Yodersen said. "You can count on their discretion as long as you pay for it." "All right, I need blood removed from my left lung then," I said. "And use a local anesthetic. I can't afford to go under."
"If that's all you need, we don't need to cut you open at all. We'll insert a tube down your throat, charge the liquid, and then use magnets to draw it up out of there. We do it for pneumonia patients all the time. You'll still need a local because it tends to hurt like hell, but you'll remain conscious. Good enough?"
"Perfect. Treat this whole thing as outpatient because I need you to let me go right afterward, and you should bill full costs to Magnuson and Hulk. No insurance. Include in your records whatever tests and exams you'd do for a normal human. You know the drill, I'm sure. Make sure you mention the bullet hole and what a good job you did patching it up, because this is going to get looked at by the cops. No way around it."
"Am I removing a bullet?"
"No, it passed through me, and they're digging it out of my shop somewhere."
"So you're sure it traveled cleanly between your ribs? I don't have to worry about any bone chips floating around."
"As certain as I can be. I'm just half drowned." We entered an elevator and paused until the doors closed.
"Would you mind if I did a chest x-ray to be sure? The cops are going to want to see one anyway. Kind of a standard procedure."
"Well, I've already plugged up the holes in my lung and the entry and exit wounds too, so it's going to look a bit odd."
Yodersen scowled for the first time. Until then, he'd been conversing with half a grin on his face.
"That was probably more efficient than you should have been."
"Well, you're going to charge me thousands for chest bandages I'll never use, so I figure we're even. You and your team will just have to lie convincingly on the stand when you get called up. The elevator bell dinged and the doors opened, and the nurses rolled me into a busy hallway lined with surgical bays.
You're going to sue the cops, then?
Yoderson asked.
Sure, why not? Somebody has to pay for all this, and I'd rather it not be me.
You've got a solid case?
As solid as Hal can make it. 5 cops saw the other cops shoot me when I was standing dead still with my hands up, offering no resistance. Got it on security cam, too. You write up a good story about your medical wizardry, and it's guaranteed.
Excellent. I'll be sure to pad the bill.
You're the reason we need health care reform, you know?
Yoderson's grin returned.
There's also going to be the matter of my team's hush money.
Sure, no problem. This one's going to get a lot of attention, because the press can't leave something like this alone. Just let Hal know how much, and I'll make sure he gets it to you.
Do we have to rush this?
The faster the better. You're going to have the police and press here sooner rather than later, and I'd prefer to disappear if I can before they get here.
And so, Dr. Snorri Yoderson had me out of there by the time night fell, scooting out a side door in a wheelchair and conveniently missing all the people waiting for me in recovery. We didn't miss the guy waiting by the side door, though. That would be Detective Carlos Jimenez. He was showing some annoying signs of sentience.
You're looking pretty good for a guy who got shot in the chest, he said.
Detective, I nodded at him. How may I help you?
I need a statement.
I got shot in Tempe. You're from Phoenix. There's a statement. 2, in fact.
I know, Mr. O'Sullivan. I just need your version of events to put in my report. There's always a lot of scrutiny when a cop gets shot, and it gets insane when he gets shot by other cops. So, oblige me, will you?
All right. Detective Fagel shot me for no good reason while I had my hands up and was making no threatening movements or statements. The brave and decisive action of Detective Carlos Jimenez prevented me from suffering further injury and possibly saved my life. I'm going to sue Tempe for millions. How's that?
That was great, thanks. Where are you off to in such a hurry?
Maybe I'm going to a titty bar. It's none of your business. Come on, doctor, let's go. Snorri began to roll me forward, and as he did, Jimenez registered what was slung around the back of my wheelchair.
Hey, is that a scabbard?
Or a sword, rather?
Whoa, deja vu, I said, gesturing for Snorri to keep on pushing.
That sounds eerily like the line of questioning Detective Fagels used today when he was supposed to be searching for the dog I don't have.
If that's the sword Detective Fagels was talking about, then you removed it from a crime scene,
Jimenez replied, walking a pace or two behind us. If it is the same sword, Detective, and that's a big if, since nobody ever saw that imaginary sword but Fagels, then it's just as legally in my possession here as it was in my shop. Good evening, sir.
Wait a second, Jimenez said. Where can I find you if I need additional information?
You already know where I live and where I work, I said.
You're going home, then?
He was a persistent bugger. Tell you what, if you cannot find me at home or at work, you may contact me through Hal Hauk, my attorney. My plan had been to be out of the chair and walking north up Civic Center at this point, but Jimenez was kind of putting a crimp in my plans. He noticed this as we ran out of the parking lot and arrived at the street, where Snorri stopped pushing my wheelchair.
What,
no ride? Jimenez asked.
Good night, detective, I said pointedly.
He ignored me and addressed Snorri.
Has Mr. O'Sullivan been chucked out of the hospital, then?
Yes, on my authority.
And you are?
Dr. Snorri Yoderson.
What can you tell me about his condition, doctor?
I can tell you nothing right now, as you know. But once I receive a proper medical records request, you may, of course, read his chart and my notes yourself. And the sooner you leave me alone, the sooner I can get the paperwork finished.
Well, you're quite a pair,
Jimenez said, folding his arms across his chest and locking his knees. He said nothing more, just stood there and stared at us. I kept my gaze focused on Scottsdale Stadium across the street, and I think Snorri was returning his gaze. I bet Jimenez would blink first. Werewolves, you know. But Snorri didn't have the patience to stare him down baldly. He employed a legal argument to save time.
If you will excuse us, detective, I need to consult with my patient in private,
Snorri said, and then I could practically feel him turning on that werewolf vibe that says back the hell off.
It took about 2 seconds for Jimenez to lower his eyes. He said,
"Of course, Doctor. Good evening to you. And to you, Mr. O'Sullivan. I'll be in touch."
We made no reply as he walked south along the sidewalk for about 25 yards. Then he stopped and pulled out a pack of cigarettes from his jacket and started slapping it against his palm. He looked back at us as he put one between his lips and lit up, clearly intending to wait around to see who gave me a ride.
Annoying.
"Snorri, start walking me north towards Civic Center Park," I whispered, confident that he could hear me, and he complied.
"I'm going to cast camouflage on myself and the sword now that you're concealing me from his sight," I said. "And I'll get up while you're pushing me and walk along with you. I don't think he'll spot the movement since it's dark. When we get up to the corner of 2nd Street, we'll lose him around the corner and you can walk back, saying I caught a ride in a waiting car."
"All right," he whispered. "He's following us, and he's just pulled out his cell phone.
Can you hear who he's talking to?
Hold on."
For a few moments, there was nothing but the sound of the wheelchair thunking across cracks in the sidewalk. Then Snorri said,
"He's asking the Scottsdale police to get a car over here to tail you."
"Ha! Won't get here in time." I cast camouflage on myself and on Fragora once more and felt my energy stores dwindle down to Death Valley levels. That was the price I paid for playing wedgie games. Then I rocked myself forward onto the footrests and hopped off into the street so that Snorri could keep pushing the wheelchair as if I were still in it. I tried to take my first deep breath since getting shot and immediately discovered what a bad idea it was.
"Don't try to take a deep breath until you heal up fully," Snorri advised me as I gasped and clutched at my throat. "That local is probably wearing off, and the tissue in your throat is scraped raw and extremely dry at this point."
"Thanks for the timely warning," I whispered, over what felt like a windpipe made of molten gravel.
"That's why I get paid the big bucks," he said lightly.
"Speaking of which," I wheezed, "you might want to have Hal take a look at your report before you hand it over to the cops, just to make sure it's consistent with what actually happened."
"Will do."
I turned to look over my shoulder at Jimenez trailing us. He was picking up his pace as he saw us nearing the corner. I reached out to the wheelchair and snagged Fragora from the back and slung it over my shoulder.
"I'm going to jog up to the park now. Tell Hal I'll meet him for lunch at Rula Bula tomorrow at noon and to bring Oberon with him."
"Okay. Get well and try not to worry. We have your back."
"Thanks, Snorri. You're worth every penny."
I veered off to the right, crossing the deserted street to a wide median populated with old olive trees that gave Civic Center its peculiar character. After drawing some energy from a tree to allow me to breathe more freely, if not without pain, I left Snorri and Jimenez behind to play Where's the Druid, and jogged the last quarter mile to the Civic Center Plaza, an expansive grassy area dotted with some old oaks and the occasional bronze statue. It was a little too manicured for my taste, but it was a large enough source of natural power to take care of my healing needs. I walked a few paces into the grass and sank my fingers into the soil, reaching out with my consciousness to get to know this carefully kept landscape of modern serenity. 5 minutes of meditation revealed to me a place near an oak tree that was rarely trod upon, so I made my way there and shucked myself out of my clothes, folding them neatly and hiding them up in a crook of the tree's branches. I checked my cell phone for messages and had several texts, 2 from Hal and 1 from Perry, updating me that all was well for the moment, then turned it off to go completely incommunicado. Then, naked and camouflaged, I lay down on my right side so that my tattoos would have as much contact with the earth as possible, and put Fragora in front of me, nestled against my chest and belly. I placed some precautionary wards about myself, then instructed my body to heal and detoxify while I slept, drawing on the power of Civic Center's abundant, if somewhat chemically assisted, life energy. I had escaped Angus Ogg's machinations on this day, but at the cost of Fagel's life.